Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. So I'd love to chat today about the question of daycare for young children. Recently, daycare has been in the news here in Israel for, unfortunately, the wrong reasons. There was a terrible tragedy in which two children died and 53 were evacuated from a daycare. And there's an ongoing investigation into what the cause might have been. But seems like the daycare was certainly overcrowded, underregulated, underinspected, and we see the tragic consequences. In Israel, we have a interesting model for it in the sense that you have these traditional daycare facilities and then a concept called a mishpachton, in which it's derived from the Hebrew word for a mishpacha, and the suffix ton kind of in Hebrew means big, or is used to say a big. So basically, kind of a family that operates a slightly more casual daycare type facility. So what I'd love to know, Herman and Corin, is the age at which children go into daycare in different countries. And the question I have really is, my wife and I, so Ezra is almost 7 months, and we up to now have been, we've kept him at home. For one strategic reason, up to firstly, we both spend some time working from home, and it's an amazing blessing to be able to do this and just, you know, have this time. But also up to 6 months, that was when we could get the measles vaccine, and Israel's had, as well as that horrible tragedy with daycare, there's been another tragedy with unvaccinated babies, the measles basically. So we didn't really feel confident up to that point, and now we're beginning to have the conversation. Ezra's looking slightly nervous. His eyes are darting to the left and right as I hold him, saying, "Are you thinking about abandoning me?" So I think we both feel, you know, we both want to put him in daycare. Homeschooling hasn't even come up. That's not something either of us want. But we want to know what the kind of science says about when it's okay, how long it's okay to kind of keep them at home, and while they're at home, socializing. Ezra's first social encounter was with a man whose name can't be identified, but he began grabbing Ezra's face. And I have, I think, one of the funniest baby videos I've recorded so far, as Ezra kind of looks confused to why this other child is reaching for his face. But he enjoys these periodic interactions. My wife is good about taking him out and about. I need to get into baby wearing, so he's got a good basis of socializing, we think, but I'd love to know exactly what the science says about this and what those kind of limits are. At which point, according to the majority of opinions, is it definitely a good idea to have them in some kind of a baby setting? And speaking about tragedy, that horrible thing has really, I guess, brought up the question of regulation. Do you have any tips, Herman and Corin, if you're assessing a daycare facility and you want to make sure that it's legit, properly inspected, and that there's no risk of anything like this happening? How do you even make those assessments? Over to you.
You know, Herman, I was walking past one of the local parks yesterday, and I saw a group of toddlers playing together, and it just hit me how much of a transition that is for a family. One day, the world is just you and your baby, and the next, you are entrusting their entire well-being to a group of strangers. It is a massive leap of faith.
It really is, Corn. And it is a leap that has been on a lot of people's minds lately, especially here in Jerusalem. Herman Poppleberry here, by the way. I have been digging into some of the research because, as you know, our housemate Daniel sent us a pretty heavy prompt this week. He was talking about those tragic reports in the news regarding overcrowding and the lack of oversight in some private facilities. It is the kind of story that makes every parent second-guess their choices.
It is heartbreaking. And Daniel mentioned that he and his wife are currently in that exact stage of life with little Ezra, who is almost 7 months old now. They are working from home, which is a blessing, but they are starting to ask those big questions. When is the right time? What does the science actually say? And most importantly, how do you know a place is actually safe?
those are the right questions to be asking. And honestly, the answers vary wildly depending on where you are in the world. If you look at the typical age for starting daycare globally, it is almost entirely dictated by public policy rather than child psychology. In the United States, for example, it is not uncommon to see infants starting daycare as early as 6 weeks old because of the lack of federally mandated paid parental leave. Meanwhile, in places like Norway or Sweden, most children do not start until they are at least 12 months old, and often later, because the state supports that first year at home.
Right. And here in Israel, we have a bit of a hybrid. We have the traditional large daycare centers, which we call Meon, and then there is the Mishpachton, which Daniel mentioned. For those who do not know, Mishpachton literally means like a small family. It is usually a home-based setup with maybe 5 or 6 kids. It feels more intimate, but as we have seen in recent reports, that intimacy can sometimes hide a lack of formal oversight if the provider is not properly registered under the supervision of daycare law.
That is the crux of the issue. The smaller, more informal settings can be wonderful, but they operate in a bit of a regulatory gray area sometimes. But let us talk about the science first, because that is what Daniel was really poking at. Is there an ideal age? If you look at the literature on attachment theory, specifowly the work of people like John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth, the primary focus for the first year of life is the development of a secure attachment with a primary caregiver.
And the argument there is that having a consistent, responsive presence is what builds the foundation for future emotional regulation, right? So, if a child is in a high-quality daycare where the ratio is low and the caregivers are consistent, they can still form those attachments. But if the staff is rotating every 2 weeks, or if one person is looking after 10 babies, that attachment process gets disrupted.
Exactly. There was a major study by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development that followed over 1,000 children from birth. They found that for very young infants, under 12 months, the quality of the home environment was a much stronger predictor of development than the daycare environment. However, they also found that high-quality daycare could actually provide a boost in cognitive and language development, especially for children from less stimulating home environments. The key word there is quality.
So, it is not a black-and-white situation where home is always better or daycare is always better. It is about the quality of the interaction. But what about the socialization aspect? Daniel mentioned that Ezra is starting to notice other kids. I think there is this common misconception that babies need other babies to learn how to be social.
That is a huge one. Science suggests that for the first 18 to 24 months, children mostly engage in what we call parallel play. They might play near each other, but they are not really interacting in a complex way. Their primary social learning is coming from the adults in their lives. They are learning how to read faces, how to mirror emotions, and how to communicate needs. They do not actually need a peer group for that until they are closer to 2 or 3 years old.
That is fascinating. So the pressure parents feel to get their 1-year-old into a group setting for socialization might be slightly misplaced. They are socialized by us, the adults, first. But I suppose there is still a benefit to them seeing other children, even if they are not playing a game of tag together yet.
Oh, definitely. Exposure to different environments is good, but if you are at home, like Daniel and his wife are, you can achieve that through low-stress activities. Taking the baby to the park, visiting family, or even just being in a grocery store where they see different people. The key for socialization at home is variety and engagement. It is not about having 5 other babies in the room, it is about the baby seeing how you interact with the world.
I remember we touched on some of these developmental milestones back in episode 394, when we talked about the daycare dilemma, specifically regarding socialization. One thing that stuck with me from that discussion was the idea of the serve and return interaction. The baby makes a sound or a gesture, and the adult responds. That is the fundamental building block of social brain architecture.
Precisely. And in an overcrowded daycare, that serve and return happens less frequently. If a caregiver is overwhelmed, they are in survival mode. They are changing diapers and feeding on a schedule, but they might not have the capacity to engage in those micro-interactions that are so vital for brain development. This leads us to one of the more technical aspects of the research, which is cortisol levels.
The stress hormone. I have read about this. Some studies show that children in daycare have higher cortisol levels in the afternoon compared to children who stay at home.
Yes, and that is particularly true for children under the age of 3. The theory is that being in a group setting is inherently more taxing for a young child's nervous system. They have to navigate the noise, the lack of private space, and the presence of many other children. Now, this is not necessarily harmful in the long run if the child has a chance to decompress at home, but it does suggest that the ideal age to start a full-day, high-intensity program might be later rather than earlier.
So, if we are looking for a sweet spot based purely on the developmental data, many experts point toward the age of 2 or 3 as the time when the benefits of peer interaction really start to outweigh the potential stress of being away from the primary caregiver. But of course, we have to acknowledge the reality of the world. Most parents do not have the luxury of waiting until age 3.
Of course not. Economic necessity is the primary driver here. So the question becomes, if you have to start at 6 months or 12 months, how do you mitigate the risks? How do you ensure you are not walking into one of those nightmare scenarios Daniel mentioned?
That is the practical side of this that I think is so important. When you are assessing a facility, what are the red flags? Most people look at the toys or the colorful walls, but I suspect that is the least important part of the equation.
You are absolutely right. The physical environment matters for safety, but the soul of the daycare is the staff. The first thing I would tell anyone to look at is the staff turnover rate. If the teachers are leaving every 6 months, that is a massive red flag. It suggests either poor management, low pay, or a stressful environment, all of which trickle down to the children.
That makes total sense. High turnover means no consistency for the kids, which goes back to that attachment issue we discussed. What about the legal side? In Israel, for example, there has been a big push to ensure all facilities are under the Ministry of Education, or Misrad Hachinuch.
Yes. That transition was designed to bring professional pedagogical standards to the 0 to 3 age group. If you are looking at a daycare, the very first step is to verify their license. In many countries, there is a public database where you can check if a facility is registered and if they have had any recent violations. You should not just take their word for it. You want to see the actual paperwork, specifically their permit to operate under the current safety laws.
And what about the inspections? I think people assume that if a place is open, it is being inspected regularly. But that is not always the case, especially for those smaller mishpachten setups.
Right. You have to ask the provider directly. When was your last inspection? Who conducted it? Can I see the report? A legitimate provider will not be offended by those questions. They will be proud to show you that they are meeting the standards. If they get defensive or vague, that is a sign to walk away. Also, check for security cameras. In Israel, the law now requires cameras in all daycare centers for children under 3, though there are strict privacy regulations on who can view the footage.
Another thing I have heard is the importance of the child-to-adult ratio. There are legal minimums, but then there are best practice ratios. What should parents be looking for?
For infants under 12 months, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends a ratio of 1 adult to every 3 babies, with a maximum group size of 6. For toddlers aged 1 to 2, you are looking at 1 to 4. If you walk into a room and you see one person with 8 toddlers, even if it is technically legal in that jurisdiction, it is not ideal for development. There is no way one person can provide the necessary attention to that many children at once.
I also think about the vibe of the place. It sounds unscientific, but when you walk in, is it chaotic? Is it quiet? Is there a lot of shouting? I have been in places where the caregivers are just staring at their phones while the kids play. That is a huge red flag for me.
It should be. Active supervision is a specific skill. It means the adult is positioned so they can see everyone, they are moving around, and they are narrating what the children are doing. Oh, I see you are building a tall tower with those blue blocks. That kind of engagement is what you want to see. And honestly, Korn, one of the best ways to assess a place is to show up unannounced.
Oh, that is a bold move. Do daycares actually allow that?
A good one should. They might have security protocols, of course, but their policy should be that parents are welcome at any time. If a daycare has restricted hours for visits or tells you that you must call 24 hours in advance, that is a concern. They should have nothing to hide.
That is a great tip. And what about safety specifically? We are talking about fire safety, first aid certifications, and even the layout of the furniture.
You want to see a current first aid and CPR certification for every single staff member, not just the manager. You want to see that the electrical outlets are covered, that there are no choking hazards within reach, and that the outdoor play area is secure and has soft surfacing. Also, ask about their emergency protocols. What happens in a fire? What happens in a security situation? If they do not have a written plan that they can explain clearly, they are not prepared.
It is a lot for a parent to process, especially when you are already feeling guilty or anxious about leaving your child. But I think knowledge is the antidote to that anxiety. If you know what to look for, you can make a choice based on data rather than just a gut feeling.
Exactly. And to Daniel's point about Ezra, if they are able to stay at home for now, there is absolutely no scientific reason to rush. If they can provide a stimulating environment, get out of the house for some people, watching socialization, and maintain that strong attachment, Ezra is going to be just fine. He is not missing out on anything by not being in daycare at 7 months old.
That is probably a huge relief for them to hear. And it is a good reminder that socialization is a lifelong process. It does not start and end in a daycare room. It starts at the dinner table, in the stroller, and in the way we interact with our neighbors.
Absolutely. And as children get older, the benefits of those group settings become more apparent. By age 3, they are learning how to share, how to resolve conflicts, and how to follow a group routine. Those are vital skills for school readiness. But for an infant, the world is much smaller, and that is okay.
I think one of the most interesting things we have seen lately is the rise of co-working spaces with integrated childcare. It is almost like a modern version of the village. The parents are working nearby, but the children are in a professional, regulated setting where the parents can pop in for a nursing break or a quick cuddle.
I love that model. It bridges the gap between the isolation of working from home and the total separation of traditional daycare. It acknowledges that the all-or-nothing approach does not work for every family. We are seeing more of those cropping up in tech hubs like Tel Aviv, and I think it might be the future of childcare for the digital nomad generation.
It certainly seems more humane than the rigid systems we have had for the last 50 years. But regardless of the model, the underlying principle remains the same. The safety and emotional security of the child must come first. And that requires regulation, oversight, and a lot of vigilance from parents.
It really does. And for those who are listening and might be in the middle of this search themselves, do not be afraid to be that parent. Ask the hard questions. Demand to see the credentials. Your child's safety is worth a little bit of awkwardness during the interview process.
Well said, Herman. I think we have covered a lot of ground here, from the global policy differences to the nitty-gritty of cortisol levels and safety checklists. It is a complex topic, but I hope this gives Daniel and our other listeners some clarity.
I hope so, too. It is all about finding that balance between what the science says and what your life requires. There is no one-size-fits-all answer. But there are definitely better and worse ways to navigate the transition.
Before we wrap up, I just want to say that if you've been finding these deep dives helpful, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It genuinely helps the show grow and allows us to keep exploring these weird and wonderful prompts that Daniel and our listeners send in.
It really does make a difference. And remember, you can find our entire archive of over 400 episodes at myweirdprompts.com. We have covered everything from baby development to the future of artificial intelligence, so there is plenty to explore if you are curious.
And if you have a topic you want us to tackle, there is a contact form on the website as well. Thanks for joining us today for episode 429.
It has been a pleasure, as always. Thanks for the great questions, Korn.
Anytime, Herman Poppleberry. Until next time, this has been My Weird Prompts.
Take care, everyone.
You know, Herman, before we go, I was just thinking about Ezra and that video Daniel mentioned, the one where the other kid was grabbing his face. It is such a perfect example of that early interaction. Ezra was confused, but he was observing. He was learning that other small humans have their own agendas.
Exactly. That is the beginning of what psychologists call theory of mind. The realization that other people have thoughts and feelings and, in this case, a very strong desire to touch your nose. It is a big moment for a 7-month-old.
It really is. And it is those little moments that make the whole journey so fascinating. All right, we should probably let our listeners get back to their day.
Right, see you in the next one.
Wait, did we mention the website?
Yes, corn. You mentioned it twice. We're good. Let us go get some hummus.
My treat. Jerusalem hummus is the best in the world, after all.
No argument there. See you later, everyone.
Bye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.